The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome to the Your Favorite Band Podcast. It's your good friend, Bran.
And over here, Dave.
It feels so good to be back, Dave. It has been a little bit, and I need to tell the people, season one was like an every other week thing. Season two, there's a lot more that goes into the editing, and so it's going to be a little bit more sporadic, but it's going to be worth it because the episodes, Dave, are going to be real good.
They're going to be rich, and not only rich with production, but rich with content.
That's exactly right. Now, before we get to...
We got some hot names on our tickets.
We really do. I got to tell the people, we got a lot of really good guests lined up for season two, so I'm excited to get to all of them, and we'll get to today's person in just a second. But real quick, a couple of housekeeping things, Dave. So are you ready for it?
Clean my house.
One, if you're new to the Your Favorite Band Podcast and you like the show, maybe you found us through Darren or whatever, if you would leave us a review on iTunes, it's super helpful. A couple of you have already done it and said really nice things, so thank you for doing so. But if you haven't, please do that. Give us that 5-star, or just, you know, don't do it at all. That's fine, too. Number two, Dave, are you ready? Find us on the socials, the Twitters, the Facebook, the Instas. You can find a link on our website, yourfavoritebandpodcast.com. We post upcoming episodes and other fun things. We ask you for input and stuff like that. So, Dave, if you're not already following us, because you should be, you should do it.
And hang on a second. Yep, following.
Thank you. Number three, if you've ever been like, boy, I really want to support the podcast, but I don't know how, there are a couple ways you can do so. One, in the description of all the episodes that are coming out in season two, there are links to buy the music via Amazon. It's an Amazon affiliate link, and all that means is that the artist gets money, but also your favorite band gets money. The podcast, not your actual band, but they do. So help us out by buying music. But also, and on our website, yourfavoritebandpodcast.com, you can also click the little donate button and say, hey, I want to send Your Favorite Band Podcast $1,000. It'll help us survive, live, and excel in all of life.
Yep.
And Dave, I have one more thing to tell you.
Hand me it.
Guess who we have on the podcast today?
Oh, gosh. I only have desires and wishes at this point.
Listen, I'm going to go ahead and let this guy introduce himself. Today on the show, we have...
My name is John Mark McMillan, and I guess I write songs and I perform them.
Dave, are you ready for it?
Show me the money.
Here is... Season 2, Episode 2, John Mark McMillan, the Your Favorite Band Podcast with Bran.
Put on your tutus.
And Dave.
John Mark grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, in a not-so-musical house, and his journey to finding music that would one day inspire him to write songs himself is not exactly the journey you would expect for him.
Well, so I listened to mostly rap and R&B until I was probably 15 or 16 years old. Snoop Dogg, Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, Tupac, all of that kind of stuff was really big for me. I was probably more into rap, hip-hop, R&B, radio kind of stuff until about 8th grade. And in 7th, I went to middle school, and in 7th grade, I was my first year in middle school, 7th grade, and I got picked on a little bit, you know, and I was terrified. You know, all these very big people around me, and, you know, it was a much bigger school, you know, and I had a hard time. It was a difficult time for me, you know, and then going into 8th grade, I was getting into trouble, but it wasn't really trouble looking back. Just my grades weren't good, and my parents didn't like where my life was going. They warned me if I didn't bring my grades back up, they would make me homeschool. And so I didn't bring my grades up, and they made me finish at home. And I think during that time, a lot of the kids that I'd grown up with who were really more into the radio stuff, like really more into sports, and I was, at that time in my life, we were younger, we were friends, but at that time in my life, we were not very friendly anymore, you know. And I was kind of the fat kid in school. And so I would get picked on a lot by people who were supposedly my friends, you know, but at that age, when you're really trying to impress girls, that's how they did it, you know. And so I rebelled against them, and I, you know, and part of it was the music they listened to, and I said, well, forget that. And so, and then I started listening. They started playing more. Remember in the mid-90s, all of a sudden it's like 1 year, even the pop stations started to play like heavy rock, you know, grunge, they called it at the time. So I was listening to Nirvana and Weezer and Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and all those type of bands. And my buddy Mark came over to the house, and he brought his guitar. I hadn't seen him in a little while. He brought his guitar and a little PV Rage amplifier, and he could play all the songs from the radio. And I was at that stage in my life where, like, I really wanted to impress girls, and I was not good at sports. So I thought, well, maybe Mark could teach me how to play the guitar, and that would impress girls. And so that's where it all began for me, was trying to impress girls. I didn't really impress the girls. In fact, I ended up writing a lot of music about how I didn't impress the girls. But that was where it began, though.
If you listen to any John Mark McMillan album, you'll quickly realize that he's a very poetic songwriter. But that wasn't something that he set out to become at all.
I was not a very musical person, and so in a lot of ways I was sort of like, it's like trial and error. I was like, can I do this? Is this what a song is going to be like? You know? I was like, can I make a song out of what I'm thinking right now? You know, looking back, though, you know, I have a lot of 90s influence, you know, like, maybe some people would laugh at me, but, you know, Counting Crows were probably a really big influence. They're one of the first bands I heard where I was like, man, I really like what he's saying and the way he's saying it, you know. But to me, that's a really good example that, like, I don't think I did this on purpose, but my style of writing is a lot like that, you know. And I realized my style of writing is a lot more like the 90s writers in that, like, it's very, very stream of consciousness. And I didn't realize that. I didn't know I was doing that, you know, until people pointed out. And when I started comparing and listening to other songs, you know, like I know this sounds stupid, but until recently, I didn't realize most people have a very specific idea of what they want to say when they write a song. So that was foreign to me. Like, I didn't know that's how some people did it. You know, to me, it was always like, I feel this way. I'm not really sure why I feel this way. But how can I write something that helps other people feel the way I feel, you know? So honestly, for me, like, really where I started writing was more of a place where writing became sort of therapy for me, you know? So, like, I'd probably tried to write some songs before this, but I went through this really nasty breakup in my early 20s, you know, probably like 21. And I couldn't sleep, and so I'd stay up late and sit on my front porch, and I'd write songs all night. But I don't know that I thought people were going to hear those songs as much as I don't know. I just loved to write them, and I kind of needed to write them at the time, and that for years that became my hobby. I couldn't wait to get home from work. I couldn't wait for the sun to go down so I could sit out on my porch and, you know, write songs, you know. So I didn't really think much about why I was writing the way I did. You know, for me it was just like a really therapeutic thing to do. It's rare for me to actually finish a song. You know, most of the time for my records, every song on the record is like, that's the songs that I finished. You know, like I don't overwrite.
For John Mark, music just kind of happened. In the midst of not really knowing what he wanted to do in his life and battling depression, a few thousand dollars from his parents and MySpace happened and changed everything.
I remember having all these conversations with my parents towards the end of high school about where are you going to go to college and what are you going to study and what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't really want to do anything. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I messed around with a lot of things, and I started college, and I quit. And I went to ministry school for a little bit, and but I didn't really want to go into ministry, you know. Yeah. I think mostly I just wasn't sure who I was, you know, and I really just wanted to meet a girl, you know. Yeah. What I mean is to meet an awesome girl and start some sort of relationship, and I had no idea how I was going to pay the bills. Or anything like that. So music, I think probably secretly I really wanted to do music. I just didn't think I was good enough. And so anytime a musical opportunity would come, I would drop everything and go do that. Making music for a living wasn't really, like, didn't seem like any sort of option. You know, no one in my world or life thought that's what I was going to do for a living. That relationship fell apart, and I was so depressed that I was kind of going to college, and I went back for a little bit, and I was like, I'm done. I've tried this a couple times, and this just isn't for me. I don't like the way teachers talk to me. I don't care about any of this stuff, you know. And so my parents saw that I was super depressed, and they had saved a little bit of money to help me with college, and they gave me a few thousand dollars to record a record, just hoping this would inspire me and keep me from being depressed. You know, looking back, they didn't say that at the time, but looking back, it's like, man, they were just afraid for me because I was so depressed, right? And I think they wanted to give me something to do. So I've been playing these songs, and people have been asking me for a CD, you know, because there's no other way to get music to people back then, you know. And so everywhere I would play, you know, this group of songs, people would ask me for the song. So really I thought, well, I need to record an album because people want the songs, you know. So my first two records were like that, actually. I didn't sit down and think, I need to write a record. It was more like I already had these songs, I was playing them, and people wanted them. And I thought, well, I ought to give them the song. So it was more like a supply and demand kind of thing. Like, they seem to really want it, so I better record it. So the first record I recorded for a few thousand bucks up in the mountains with my buddy Nathan in his dad's garage. And that album is not anywhere, if I can help it, you know what I mean? The second record, Song Inside the Sounds, I borrowed, I want to say $11,000 from my mother-in-law. And we recorded the record, and I paid her all that money back, and I saved enough money. So I sold enough of those records independently. And this was still before iTunes for the most part, so I was mailing them off to people, you know, selling them through MySpace, right, and mailing them off to people. And I sold enough of those to save up, I think I'd saved up about 30 grand, and I spent that 30 grand to record the first version of The Medicine. He is jealous for me.
How He Loves is a song that has a wild story all of its own, a story that would eventually help get John Mark signed to Integrity Records almost 10 years after it was written.
I wrote the song in either 2002 or 2003. And then I recorded it on the record, the Song Side the Sounds record, which I think I recorded it in 2005. I think I put it out in 05 or 06. I can't remember off the top of my head. So like by the time, and so it started to become a popular song probably around 2009, 2010. By the time it became a popular song, I was beyond tired of playing that song, right?
Yeah.
I'd been playing it, if I'm right, and I wrote the song in 02, and it became popular in 2010, it was like 8 years, right? Or something. Something like, you know, like 6 or 8 years. And so I'd already been singing that song. I think I sang it for 4 years in a row. You know, singing a lot for 4 years. And then I'd stopped. I hadn't sang the song in a couple of years when it started to become a little bit popular again. And then I re-recorded it for The Medicine. It became kind of a popular song in certain church circles. And they wanted me to play it at a couple of big events. And I did. And then they started asking. Then I got offers to go play the song at other big events. And I started telling them no. So, because I was just kind of done with it. And not that I don't like the song, I just sort of moved on. And then Kim Walker Smith, I remember she called me. She was a friend of mine. She sang backup with my sister-in-law for a while, and she stayed out in North Carolina for a little bit. And, you know, and she had started to lead worship some and to sing her own songs a little bit. And she called me and said, hey, because I can't remember this big conference, they wanted me to come sing it. And I said no, because I didn't want to do it. And so Kim said, hey, is it okay if she did it? You know. And so she sang it, and that was when the song really started to explode. My buddy John handed it to Eddie Kirkland, and he recorded it. And then David Crowder heard Eddie Kirkland's version of the song on an airplane, and he decided he wanted to record it. And then it kind of became a big song. But the thing is, like, when I got signed to Integrity, they were really cool. But I think they expected me to like own that song and be like the guy of that song, and I was like done. I was like, I'm more than happy for other people to do the song. You know, they're like, you okay if other people do the song? It's like, I hope they do, because I don't want to do it anymore. I hope that doesn't sound bad. Like I like the song. It's just such an old song. I was sort of like, guys, I've written a whole other record between the time I wrote the song, and I'm sort of like way more into the stuff I'm working on now. You know,
yeah.
So it's never bothered me if people don't think I wrote it. You know, it doesn't bother me at all. It was really great for that time in my life when I needed the song, you know, and now it's sort of moved on. Yeah, he loves us. Whoa, how he loves us. Whoa, how he loves us. Whoa, how he loves. There was a moment in time, though, where, you know, I could see something interesting happening with that song. You know, when all of a sudden I started getting asked to go play the song, you know, and I was like, something really interesting is happening. People are asking me because of this particular song, you know. And that was especially because, like, at the time I'm not on a record label. I'm not really in the music industry. I'm selling CDs out of the trunk of my car and mailing them to people through MySpace, you know. And so I started to realize something really interesting was happening. I hadn't done any videos at that point. I had no video content whatsoever. I also didn't really want video content. I started doing videos after I saw a bunch of really terrible live videos people had filmed and put on YouTube, and I realized I had to fight fire with fire because I just couldn't shut them down fast enough. You know? But they were all around that song, and so I wasn't surprised. But also at the time, like, I really didn't know what other worship songs sounded like, to be honest.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
I wasn't really in that world, so I really didn't know what other songs sounded like. So the guy who wanted to sign me brought that song to the table, and everyone told him that this is not a worship song. No one's going to sing this. It's weird. I found all this out later. So, you know, so he, I remember stories of him getting into huge arguments, and after a year, he wore them down, and they signed me. They reached out and signed me.
John Mark got signed to Integrity in the midst of getting a lot of different offers from a lot of different labels, and it was during that time that he would have to figure out exactly what kind of artist he wanted to be, or whether or not he wanted to be on a label at all.
Well, you know, the label, it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of pressure from the label. I mean, I knew what they wanted, but the people I was working with had told me from the beginning, and at the time I had a lot of offers. Like I had multiple labels, including some really big ones, offer me a deal. And the reason I went with Integrity was because they told me I could do whatever I wanted, you know?
Okay.
And that was important to me, you know? So I think they were probably nervous and they had their fingers crossed because I'm pretty sure they knew what they wanted. They really wanted more Howie Loves type songs, but they didn't say that to me because they knew that I wouldn't take it very well. I hate having conversations with people about what I'm going to do, you know? So you want to record a song or some songs, you got to send some demos in and convince them, okay, it's time to do it. So they're going to put up some money. Who are you going to work with? Why, you know, so how are we going to, what's the angle here, you know? And like, there's just so many people involved. Like I've only done a handful of records with labels, even some really good labels. And I just hate it. It's just too many cooks in the kitchen. Like, if I change my mind about something, I just want to change it. I don't want to, like, have to share with everybody why I'm changing my mind. And not because, like, I'm, like, better or I know better than anyone else does. It's just, like, you burn a lot of energy dealing with people. And I would rather burn that energy on the songs and in the studio than burn all that creative energy trying to figure out how to get things done. You know, and that's really the problem with the labels. It's just, it's like, you have to have so many conversations about something before it happens. You know, it got to the point where I stopped having conversations. I just started doing it and then having the conversations later. You know, if I wanted to do it, I would just go do it and pay for it myself and just hope that I'd get reimbursed down the road because I was just tired of trying to get them on board. And they weren't contrary or, you know, and apparently that's just normal for label life. Like, is, you know, it's just a lot of people. And I just never had, just because from the beginning I'd been independent, I didn't like all the work you had to do just to get everybody on board. I didn't really let them speak into the songs. So I sent them the songs. I'm like, hey, this is going to be the album. You know? But in order to get the money, it's like, I'm like, hey, it's 2 weeks. I sent you the songs. Are we cool? I'm ready to go. You know, I want to use this producer. Are you cool with this? And 2-3 weeks later, yeah, I think we're cool with that. Like, who's going to mix it? And what's our budget? And I'm waiting on all this stuff, you know? But, like, I didn't even do any demos. Like, I did voice memos on my phone, and I sent them into the A&R guy, you know? And I'm like, okay, are you cool? Because I think this is what we're going to do. No one ever sat me down and said, we want these type of songs, or you need to write this way. And I think they knew from the beginning that that wasn't going to work out with me, you know, because I came in pretty guns blazing. I almost put in my contract, John Mark will allow no creative input from the label. And they said, well, we can't really do it like that. So they set up this whole thing where we had this system of where if what I was doing, they had a problem with it, I could get, you know, 2 or 3 other people in the industry to, like, kind of counsel us through it. It was a really interesting contract, but...
After Economy was released, John Mark decided it was time to go back to being independent. But with that comes a ton of hard work finding out how to continue to make money while making music.
It's really hard to make money selling music anymore. Like the real money is on the road, you know, and I've got 3 kids now, and I just don't want to be out on the road more and more. And I've always felt early on, we traveled so much, you know, since I've been doing this full time since 2006. So for 11 years, we've been traveling, And I always felt like I was working towards not traveling. I thought I was paying my dues when I was younger by all the traveling that we did. And so it started to bum me out. And it's like, okay, sales, like I am selling more records and I'm reaching more people than ever before. My audience is way bigger than it's ever been, but I'm making way less money off of sales, you know? And so all the, you know, almost everyone else that I know is like, well, you got on the road because that's where you make the money. And I was like, but I've done that for a long time and now I have kids, and I thought I was working towards touring less. You know, I thought that was the plan. You know, that's my 10-year plan. Tour less, build your audience up independently, sell more records, and then you don't have to tour as much. And I like touring. I actually love touring. I was like, but it's really hard on a family, right? So, you know, so I was like, how do I continue to like be a family man? And I still tour a good bit. I was like, I don't want to be on the road 200 days a year. You know, I don't want to, that's not what I want to do. And so, so crowdfunding became the sort of the way to like, okay, well, we'll crowdfund the record and we'll sort of, it's more of a pre-sale. We're pre-selling the record, and what we're selling is the process, is people get videos and I'm, you know, and fans get to sort of live along with the record, you know? So it's not just they get the record before everybody else, but they get updates, you know, during the recording and writing process, you know? And I thought that was really exciting. Like, that's something I would have done with one of my favorite artists, you know, to follow them along the way. I remember thinking, like, you know, when is... I don't know who I was way into back in the day. When is Pearl Jam going to come out with a new record? You know what I mean? And if I could have followed along, it would have just been, like, amazing. You know, I would have loved it. So I thought that was a really... great way to do the record, because we just didn't know how much money we were going to make when we actually put them, you know, because it's almost like a release date's almost like a leak date, you know. So I'm trying to make as money as I can before you leak it, you know, and then the money starts trickling in. It's not like we're hurting, you know what I mean? It's just more challenging now. I used to know what we would make when we put out a record, so I knew how much money I could put into it. Because I knew we'd sell X number of, you know, on iTunes, and, you know, we had a good idea of what we would make the first quarter, and now I just don't know.
But with his independence also came more freedom. Freedom to experiment with sounds and tones, and even lyrical themes.
I was much more into... like true indie rock back in the day. Now indie has become like it's kind of a genre, you know? But back when I was younger, like indie rock meant like it was made independently and it was real cheap and it sounded cheap and we all thought that was awesome, you know? All those like old, you know, indie rock records from the late 90s, Elliott Smith and... you know, it sounded like you did it in your garage and you're proud of it. You know what I mean? Like, and I even remember telling the producers, like, I don't want too much low end. Like, I don't want this record to be too big sounding. You know, like, I want it to sound, you know, we thought that was cool and authentic and rock and roll for it to sound kind of crappy. You know? And so that's what we were really into. I think that changed a lot with the dawn of the iPhone, right? When all of a sudden, like, those old records, which sound so beautifully crappy, sound just like so uninspiring through a mono iPhone speaker. You know, all those old records sound so bad. So people started mixing records differently when people started listening to music on their laptop speakers and on their iPhone. So I think and honestly that became indie, because all of a sudden like the independent guys and, you know, the independent folks started recording on their laptops, you know, and so they started using sounds that are more conducive to that. I don't want my records to sound the same. I never want to feel like I'm going backwards. But for the most part, when we're in the studio, I'm more just trying to figure out, like, what sounds, you know, good to me. You know, I don't think I go in saying I'm going for this particular type of sound. Normally we go in and just make a big mess and like, okay, I really like the way this is going. Let's focus here. You know, like, definitely for a little bit for Borderland, but definitely for the new record, I was just totally not inspired by guitars at all. And it's not even that I was like, we need synths versus guitars. I think it's just more like guitars were just not inspiring me, so it just sort of things fall on organ and pianos and synth. In fact, a lot of the stuff on the new record that sounds like synth is actually real instruments that we just messed with really heavily on in post. And I think the bigness of it was, I think it was the first time I was like, okay, we can make something really big sounding and it can be cool. You know, I can, it doesn't have to have all these layers and all this texture, you know. But I was working with a new production team too, and they, you know, leaned more in that direction, you know, in a little bit more polished direction. Yeah.
In 2015, John hit the studio with his wife, Sarah, to record a worship EP. And surprisingly enough, the production of the EP is what stood in the way of there being even more songs.
Originally, so my wife is a songwriter, and she'd had these songs, and I really wanted to encourage her, especially after we had kids. I think she was feeling a little bit creatively drained. And I thought, I was like, I really want to give her some opportunity to do something that gives her some life, you know. She had these songs that she'd never recorded, and I really wanted her to record the songs. And she didn't have, you know, she didn't feel like, she felt like she had the confidence at the time to go in and record a record. You know, she felt like she couldn't write enough songs. I was like, okay, well, let's do a record together. It's sort of me trying to trick her into doing a record, you know. So I had sort of these leftover ideas from Borderland, and so I wrote a few songs and sort of brought her songs. She wrote one new song, and we did the EP. I think we were going to do a whole record together, but it just became such a fight with the production team at the time to get anything done. I finally bailed, and I said, okay, it's just going to be an EP because I just can't fight anymore to try and get this record out. We worked on that for over a year. You know, so we worked on it for over a year. And it's funny, like, I know we did the record together, but we probably spent about 3 days in the studio together. And then she doesn't care about all the details. Then I spent the rest of the time with the musicians and the producer. So in an odd way, I don't feel like we worked together on that record. You know, I'd bring stuff to her. She's like, yeah, that sounds great. You know? And she was into it. It wasn't like she didn't like it or didn't. It's not like she didn't care about the record. She just doesn't really care about the details. She likes singing and she likes writing songs. But she's really, production stuff is like, she wants it to make her feel great. You know, but I'm more into the details and all the creative little nuances and things like that.
John Mark's latest album, Mercury and Lightning, came out in 2017, but that album didn't come easily. Not sure of what to write about, and at a crossroads with his faith, what ended up being released is one of the most vulnerable and honest releases of his career.
After The Avalanche came out, I decided that it was time to move on from my production team for a number of reasons, and they're really good and they're really creative, and we did several records, but I also started to think, like, I did four projects with the same production team, and maybe it was time for a new season, you know. But also we'd had some conflict, you know, and so I thought it was time to move on. But you know, being independent, like, I hadn't worked with a lot of different people, and the only record I had done outside of this particular team is my worst selling record. Let me just put it that way. And that whole season didn't go very well, so I was really sort of scared to try something new. And so it took me a long time, you know. So I didn't know who I wanted to work with. I didn't know where I wanted to record it. I didn't know what I wanted to say. And I was just kind of in a beat up place, you know? So it was a really weird time where I was like, I just don't know anything I want to do definitively with my career. At the end of Borderland, I had to make a hard decision. Like, for a little while, I'm like, I'm not going to do church stuff because I'm just kind of done. And You know, I was like, but what am I going to do? You know, we tried our hand at radio. It didn't go very well. You know, and so I just didn't, I didn't really know where I existed or where I lived. We had booked a tour that didn't do very well, and I was a little bit depressed. And, you know, I think probably after Borderland came out, I waited too long to put out a new record, and some of the energy had died down, you know. And I don't think I knew where I was as an artist. And honestly, I didn't know where I was with my faith. You know, my marriage is awesome, but it also was under a lot of stress because I'd been traveling a lot and I had three small kids. I just found myself in this place where I was like, I just don't know if I'm supposed to do this music thing anymore, but what else am I supposed to do? It's this real ambiguous place, man. I think it was basically a midlife crisis. You know? I was like, I don't know anything about anything. And I hadn't felt that way since I was in college. So here I am, and I'm like, well, I need to write a new record. And I, my buddy Gabe lives just outside of Portland, Oregon. He'd been trying to do something with me for a long time. And I'd been flying a lot. And I needed one more trip across the country to get my diamond status with Delta. And so I flew out to Portland, and in 2 days we recorded the Wilder Love song. My buddy Jesse, who played in my live band for a long time, drove down from Seattle. We did the Wilder Love song. I was like, this is so much fun. I was like, I don't know where this fits into my catalog, but who cares? Like, let's just start from scratch. New record, new whatever. You know, this is fun. I like it. There's a lot of life in it. And so I just said, okay, let's do a record. You know, and that's how we jumped into the Mercury and Lightning record. It still took a little bit longer than I thought because I didn't know what I had to say. And to be honest, I was sort of working through this crisis of faith. And when you're kind of known for like being a person who makes statements about faith and then you don't know what you believe anymore, like it's a problem professionally. You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's a problem. And so I was waiting to get my stuff figured out. And it just, I wasn't figuring it out. And finally, Gabe is like, one day, he's like, why don't you just write a record about not having it figured out? And it's like, you know what, Gabe? I think that's what we're going to do, because that's about all I can do.
And so that's what he did. He wrote an album that dealt with all the things he was tackling in his own mind and in his heart about the very faith that his career was, in part, built on.
It wasn't even like church had let me down. You know, I like church because I like people, and church is made up of people, but I've also learned over the years, like growing up a pastor's kid, like people will always let you down, you know, and I don't say that in a cynical way. It's just sort of like, you know, so like it wasn't that church let me down. Like I sort of expect church to reflect humanity, you know. They're just some like really, really glorious people. And there are just, and there's some really, really confused people, you know, and that's church. And so people that have problems with church just have problems with humanity, because it's just people have problems. And if you're involved with people, there's going to be issues. So it wasn't so much that, as much as I think my travels, like I met so many different types of people over the last 10 years, you know. And early on, I was so sure about so many things. You know, and just over the years, I started to think, like, is this a valid question to ask? Can I ask this question? And then why can I not ask this question? Why do I have it right? And why is everyone else wrong? You know, so this contradiction started to float around in my brain. So one is like, greatest in the kingdom is a servant, you know, like, it talks about humility. It's the humble person, you know. The what is it that God gives grace to the humble, right? But I like think I know everything, you know. I'm like, so if I'm humble, isn't an aspect of humility allowing yourself to consider that you are not right about something, you know? It doesn't mean you approach things blindly, you know. And so I think things started to unravel in a certain way based around a lot of those questions that I just wrestled with for years, you know, but I was too busy to really sit down and deal with them. And then they all sort of caught up to me when I had sort of the midlife crisis before the record. I think that was the moment I was like, okay, like, I really need to consider these questions here because they're not going away, you know. And I think, too, you know, having children changes the way you see the world, you know, and also just realizing even in the church, there's so many different types of people. So you can say, like, one person's right and one person's wrong and not even leave the faith, you know, and seeing how people disagreed with each other. Also realizing a lot of the things that I grew up being taught are not even necessarily in Scripture, you know. Things like eternal conscious torment, like, is not heavily supported by Scripture, you know?
Sure.
Like, and so I think when you're young, I think people have very solid answers for you about things. When you get older and you talk to those same people, you realize, like, they're kind of confused too, and they'll admit it to you. I've actually come to a really magnificent peace. Number one is that if Jesus is real, and I believe that he's real, it's really his job. It's his job to be real. It's not my job to make him real, you know? And it's not saying that, like, it's not my job to pursue the truth, right? But, you know, if at the end of the day, trusting Jesus is what it means to have faith, right? Then I'll trust Jesus, right? And then it's not my job to make sure that he's real and he's doing his job. It's just my job to trust. But, and so why can I trust Jesus? I guess the answer is that I'm okay with the mystery, you know? I think there's more to it than that. I think the Jesus way of living is the better way. You know, and the more I dig into it, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, love your neighbor as yourself, you know, all the blessings and, all, you know, like, it is the better way. Forgiveness, it's the better way, you know. And so for me, it's I do believe in Jesus, you know, and I do believe that pursuing Jesus is the better way. And I think that wherever I end up, that is the path that's going to lead me to the best place. But ultimately, I think what's most important is I'm here right now, you know. And so the most important thing is who I am here and now, you know. Because that's what I do have the power to, you know. That's what I do have the power to. I have the power to affect the present, right? To be here in the present. And so I want to apply the kingdom and the ideas of the kingdom now in the present, you know, and not, yeah, and not just project into the future. To me, that's more of what the Bible is about. That's more what Jesus is about, is teaching you how to live and not just teaching you about immortal life, not eternal life, not teaching you how to be immortal as much as teaching you how to live in the first place. I love the way the record turned out, you know, and it turns out I had a lot more to say than I thought, you know. I just had to get over what people were going to think about me not knowing everything.
John Mark is an interesting artist for many reasons, one being that he walks the line between being a worship artist and being just another indie rock artist. And so the question remains, if he could do it all over again, would he change anything?
It's all part of the narrative, right? So if it was different in the beginning, I don't know that it would be what it is now. Like, part of me wants to say, yes, I will just ignore the genre altogether, you know, and just be an artist. And I think early on, I wasn't confident in my ability to be an artist. And I think I leaned a little bit more on the, that, you know, I felt like I needed this sort of worship thing. But I also really loved it. And there's a time in my life, and there still is, you know, a place where I really love what worship can be. You know, and I think in the beginning, this is what I thought. If I could do whatever I wanted, I would approach worship music as though it was an art form. Because limitations sort of are what define art, right? And early on, I thought, I want to approach this worship thing as though it was an art form. You know? And then I realized, like, well, that's just music. You know? I was like, that's what music is. You know?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I think I'd be more confident as an artist, you know, but I don't think I would deny the sort of existential aspects of my writing, you know. At the end of the day, like, that's what I'm obsessed with, this sort of existential ideas about God and life and death. That's what I like to write about. I don't write about those things because I feel like I have to, you know. Like, I have friends who, when I wanted to get more into radio, I had a couple opportunities to have some general market radio play that didn't work out great, and I realized because the subject matter is just a little weird, you know. I was like, well, I'll write about relationships. Everyone else does. And I realized, like, I just really suck at writing about relationships because I'm just more obsessed with, like, what happens, you know, when you die. I don't know. Maybe not happens when you die, but more obsessed with, like, this idea of, like, you are going to die one day. What does that mean? You know, that's more interesting for me to write about than relationship. That may lock me into a genre, spiritual, Christian, or whatever, you know, but I'm really fascinated with that.
John Mark has been vocal about his problems with the CCM market and his desire for worship music to be more artistic. So does he hate CCM? And how does he think it could improve?
See, I remember in the 90s, at least my worship experience, like, worship was so weird in the best way, you know? Like, you could have a person stand up with an acoustic guitar, an out-of-tune acoustic guitar, and sing the weirdest lyrics, and it was like, and people would, you know, jump up and down and, you know, do their best to sing along. You know, you could make a song up on the spot and people would sing along with you. Like, that's my experience of worship, you know? So, like, making it too easy for people, just, like, no risk, no reward, right? You know? And so, in my mind, it's like, if I've got to make it so stupidly easy for you to get involved, then do you really get anything out of it? You know what I mean? So, I have no problem with writing singable songs, you know? And I think my whole issue is actually less about whether or not CCM is right or wrong, and more about, like, why do we feel like it's right for everybody? You know, it's sort of like everyone wants, you know, a solution, but it's like the solution for who? You know what I mean? Like, my family is different than the family next door. My church is different than the other 800 churches in my city. You know, and that's the way it's supposed to be, and that's beautiful. The diversity of that is really, really awesome, you know? And so that's my whole thing, is why does there have to be one single format that we all adhere to? It's not that I don't like the format. It's just, like, why do we feel like we all have to do the same thing? That just, you know, that's my problem. It's like, I have no problem with Chris Tomlin. I think he's great. I've met him before. He's a real sweet guy. He also is a really great songwriter. And writing simple pop songs is very hard. People act like it's easy. I have friends who are like, I could do that all day long. It's like, no, you actually can't. Writing something simple is harder than writing something complex. Because something simple has to make sense with the fewest elements possible, you know? And that's not an easy thing to do, you know? So I have a lot of appreciation for the CCM world. It's just not my world, you know? It's just not where I belong. And I don't hate it, you know? It just isn't where I'm supposed to be. But at the same time, it's like there's a lot of music in the world, and there's a lot of different types of people. So, you know, I guess maybe I pushed back early on because I felt like if you're going to do worship music, you got to do it this way. And my whole question is not that that way is wrong, but my question is why? Why do I have to do it that way? And the answers people gave me were always seemed so ridiculous to me.
John Mark's now back in the studio working on a whole bunch of exciting things. new stuff to come out very soon.
No, we're making a record right now. I'm doing alternate versions of all the Mercury and Lightning songs, much like the Borderlands session, so kind of acoustic versions of everything. So that's exciting, but I'm also considering doing this EP with the same team. I've got this idea about life, you know, about how life is winning, you know?
Yeah.
And anyway, I won't go into that. Hey, this is John Mark McMillan, and this is my new song, Wilderlove.
On the Badlands as a child, where the dust devils dance on the dreams of the ivy wild. In places you grow up, the tumbling ground is rough, and there is no domestic heart. So what have we become? Just pedestrian. There is no domestic heart. The wheel of love is hidden within us, and we're wrecking with it, and we're wrestling with it. The wheel of love is hidden within us. Expands, and I feel so underdressed, so civilized and small by the powers that you possess. The places you grow up, the tumbling ground is rough. There is no domestic heart. So what have we become? Just pedestrians.
Oh,
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.